Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from Great Short Stories of the Masters, edited by Charles Nieder. Benediction by Lu Sun. 1. The end of the year, according to the lunar calendar, is after all the right time for a year to end. A strange, almost New Year sort of atmosphere seems to overlay everything. Pale gray clouds at evening, against which flash the hot little fires of crackers, giving a thunderous boost to the kitchen god's ascent into heaven. And as one draws into it, the scene grows noisier, and scattered on the air is the sting of gunpowder. On such a night I return to Lo Ching, my hometown, as I call it, but in reality I have no home there at all. I stay with Lo Shi Lao Ye, a relative one generation older than myself, a fellow who ought to be called fourth uncle, according to the Chinese family way of reckoning. He is Jian Sheng, and talks all the time about the old virtues and the old ethics. I find him not much changed, a little aged, of course, but still without a whisker. We exchange salutations. After the "how are you," he tells me I've grown fat. With that done, he at once commences a tirade against the new party. But I know that the phrase to him still means poor Kong Yu Wei, and not the Renaissance, of which he probably has not even heard. We have at any rate nothing in common, and before long I'm left alone in the study. Next day I get up very late, and after lunching go out to call on some relatives and friends. The day after is the same, and the day after that. None of them has changed much. Each is a little older, and everywhere they are busily preparing for New Year prayers of blessing. It is a great thing in Lo Ching. Everyone exerts himself to show reverence, exhausts himself in performing rites, and falls down before the god of benediction to ask favors for the year ahead. There is much chicken killing, geese slaughtering, and pork buying. Women go round with their arms raw and red from soaking in hot water, preparing such fowl. When they are thoroughly cooked, they are placed on the altar with chopsticks punched into them at all angles and offered up as sacrifices at the sixth watch. Incense sticks and red candles are lighted, and the men, no women allowed, make obeisance and piously invite the blessing spirits to eat away. And after this, of course, the crackers. Every year it is that way, and the same in every home, except those of the miserable poor who cannot buy either sacrifices or candles or crackers, and this year is like any other. The sky is dark and gloomy, and in the afternoon snow falls, flakes like plum blossoms darting and dancing across a screen of smoke and bustle, and making everything more confused. By the time I return home, the roof tiles are already washed white, and inside my room seems brighter. The reflection from the snow also touches up the large crimson character, longevity, which hangs on a board against the wall. It is said to be the work of the legendary Chen Chuan Lao Tzu. One of the scrolls has fallen down and is rolled up loosely and lying on the long table, but the other still admonishes me. Understand deeply the reason of things, be moderate and be gentle in heart and manner. On the desk, under the window, are incomplete volumes of the Kangxi Dictionary, a set of recent thoughts with collected commentaries in the four books. How depressing. I decided to return tomorrow at the very latest to the city. The incident with Sing Ling Sao also has very much disturbed me. This afternoon I went to the eastern end of town to visit a friend, and while returning I encountered her at the edge of the canal. The look in her staring eyes showed clearly enough that she was coming after me, so I waited. Although other folk I used to know in Lo Ching have apparently changed little, Sang Lin Sao was no longer the same. Her hair was all white, her face was alarmingly lean, hollow, and burnt a dark yellow. She looked completely exhausted, not at all like a woman not yet 40, but like a wooden thing with an expression of tragic sadness carved into it. Only the movement of her lustrousless eyes showed that she still lived. In one hand she carried a bamboo basket. Inside it was an empty broken bowl, and she held herself up by leaning on a bamboo pole. She had apparently become a beggar. I stood waiting to be asked for money. "So, you've come back?" "Yes." That's good and very timely. Tell me, you are a scholar, a man who has seen the world, a man of knowledge and experience. Her faded eyes very faintly glowed. Tell me, I just want to ask you one thing. I could not in 10,000 tries have guessed what she would ask. I waited, shocked and puzzled, saying nothing. She moved nearer, lowered her voice, and spoke with great secrecy and earnestness. It is this. After a person dies, is there indeed such a thing as the soul? Involuntarily I shuddered. Her eyes stuck into me like thorns. Here was a fine thing. I felt more embarrassed than a schoolboy given a surprise examination, with a teacher standing right beside him. Whether there was such a thing as a soul had never bothered me, and I had speculated little about it. How could I reply? In that brief moment, I remembered that many people in Loching believed in some kind of spirits, and probably she did too. Perhaps I should just say it was rather doubtful, but no, it was better to let her go on hoping. Why should I burden a person obviously on the last road with even more pain? Better for her sake say yes. Perhaps, I stammered. Yes, I suppose there is. Then there is also a hell? A hell? She had trapped me, and I could only continue placatingly. Hell? Well, to be logical, I dare say there ought to be, but then again there may not be. What does it matter? Then in this hell do all deceased members of a family come together again face to face? Seeing face to face, eh? I felt like a fool. Whatever knowledge I possessed, whatever mental dexterity, was utterly useless. Here I had been confounded by three simple questions. I made up my mind to extricate myself from the mess and wanted to repudiate everything I had said. But somehow I could not do so in the gaze of her intensely earnest and tragic eyes. That is to say, in fact, I cannot definitely say. Whether there is a soul or not in the end, I am in no position to deny or affirm. With that she did not persist, and, taking advantage of her silence, I strode away with long steps and hastened back to Fourth Uncle's home, feeling very depressed. I could not help thinking that perhaps my replies would have an evil effect on her. No doubt her loneliness and distress had become all the more unbearable at this time, when everyone else seemed to be praying for benediction, but perhaps there was something else on her mind. Perhaps something had recently happened to her. If so, then my answers might be responsible. For what? I soon laughed about the whole thing and at my absurd habit of exaggerating the importance of casual happenings. Educators unquestionably would pronounce me mentally unbalanced. Hadn't I, after all, made it clear that all I could say was, cannot definitely say? Even should all my replies be refuted, even if something happened to the woman, it could in no way concern me. Cannot definitely say is a very convenient phrase. Bold and reckless youths often venture so far as to offer a positive opinion on critical questions for others, but responsible people, like officials and doctors, have to choose their words carefully, for if events belie their opinion, then it becomes a serious affair. It is much more advisable to say, cannot definitely say. Obviously, it solves everything. This encounter with the woman mendicant impresses upon me the importance of that practice, for even in such cases the deepest wisdom lies in ambiguity. Nevertheless, I continue to feel troubled, and when the night is gone I wake up with the incident still on my mind. It is like an unlucky presentiment of a movement of fate. Outside, the day is still gloomy, with flurrying snow, and in the dull study my uneasiness gradually increases. Certainly I must go back to the city tomorrow. To be sure, there is still unsampled the celebrated pure-cooked fish fins at Fu Xing Lu. Excellent eating and very cheap at only $1 a big salver. Has the price by now increased? Although many of my boyhood friends have melted away like clouds in the sky, there must remain at least the incomparable fish fins of Lo Ching, and these I must eat even though I eat alone. All the same, I am returning tomorrow. Because I have so often seen things happen exactly as I predicted, but hoped against, and tried to believe improbable, so I am not unprepared for this occasion to provide no exception. Towards evening, some of the family gather in an inner room, and from fragments of their talk I gather they are discussing some event with no little annoyance. Presently all the voices cease except one, that of fourth uncle, who thunders out above the thud of his own pacing feet. Not a day earlier, nor a day later, but just at this season she decided upon it. From this alone we can see that she belongs to a species utterly devoid of a human sense. My curiosity is soon followed by a vague discomfort, as if these words have some special meaning for me. I go out and look into the room, but everyone has vanished. Suppressing my increasing impatience, I wait until the servant comes to fill my teapot with hot water. Not until then am I able to confirm my suspicions. Who was it fourth uncle was blowing up about a while ago? Could it, after all, have been any other than Tsang Lin Tsao? He replies in the brief and positive manner of our language. What has happened to her? I demand in an anxious voice. Aged. Dead? My heart twinges and seems to jump back. My face burns. But he doesn't notice my emotion at all, doesn't even lift his head, so that I control myself to the end of further questioning. When did she die, then? When? Last night, or possibly today, I cannot definitely say. What did she die of? What did she die of? Could it indeed be anything else than that she has been strangled to death by poverty? His words are absolutely colorless, and without even looking at me, he goes out. My terror at first is great. But I reason that this is a thing which was bound to happen very soon, and it is merely an accident that I even know about it. I further reassure my conscience by recalling my non-committal cannot definitely say, and the servants report that it was simply a case of strangled to death by poverty. Still, now and then, I feel a prick of guilt, I don't know exactly why, and when I sit down beside the dignified old fourth uncle, I am continually thinking of opening a discussion about Tsang Lin Tsao. But how to do it? He still lives in a world of religious interdicts, and at this time of year, these are like an impenetrable forest. You cannot, of course, mention anything connected with death, illness, crime, and so on, unless it's absolutely imperative. Even then, such references must be disguised in a queer riddle language in order not to offend the hovering ancestral spirits. I torture my brain to remember the necessary formula, but at last I cannot recall the right phrases, and at length I had to give it up. Fourth uncle, throughout the meal, wears an austere look on his face. At last I suspect that he regards me also as belonging to a species utterly devoid of human sense, since neither a day earlier nor a day later, but just at this season, I have put in an appearance. To loosen his heart and save him further anxiety, I tell him that I have determined to return tomorrow. He doesn't urge me to stay very enthusiastically, and I conclude that my surmise was correct. And thus, in a cheerless mood, I finish my meal. The short day is ended, the curtain of snow dropping over it earlier than usual even in this month, and the black night falls like a shroud over the whole town. People still busy themselves under the lamplight, but just beyond my window there's a quiet of death. Snow lies like a down mattress over the earth, and the still falling flakes make a faint sound that adds to the intense loneliness and the unbearably melancholy. Sitting alone under the yellow rays of the rape oil lamp, my mind goes back again to that blown-out flicker, Tsang Lin Tsao. This woman who once stood among us in this house, thrown now like an old toy, discarded by a child, on to the dust heap. For those who find the world amusing, for the kind for whom she is created, no doubt if they think about her at all, it's simply to wonder why the devil she should so long have had the effrontery to continue to exist. Well, she has obliged them by disappearing at last, swept away thoroughly by Wu Chang, and a very tidy job. I don't know whether there is such a thing as a soul that lives on after death, but it would be a great improvement if people like Tsang Lin Tsao were never born, would it not? Then nobody would be troubled, neither the despised nor those who despise them. Listening to the of the leafy autumnal snow, I go on musing, and gradually find some comfort in my reflections. It is like putting together an intricate puzzle, but in the end the incidents of her life fit together into a single whole. 2. Tsang Lin Tsao was not a native of Lo Qing. She arrived in early winter one year with old woman Wei, who bargained in the labor of others. Fourth uncle had decided to change the servant, and Tsang Lin Tsao was old woman Wei's candidate for the job. She wore a white scarf wrapped around her head, a blue jacket, a pale green vest, and a black skirt. She was perhaps 26 or 27, still quite young and rather pretty, with ruddy cheeks and a bronzed face. Old woman Wei said that she was a neighbor of her mother's. Her husband had died, she explained, and so she had to seek work outside. Fourth uncle wrinkled up his brow, and his wife, looking at him, knew what he meant. He didn't like hiring a widow. But fourth aunt scrutinized her carefully, noting that her hands and feet looked strong and capable, and that she had honest, direct eyes. She impressed her as a woman who would be content with her lot and not likely to complain about hard work. And so, in spite of her husband's wrinkled brow, fourth aunt agreed to give her a trial. For 3 days she worked as if leisure of any kind bored her. She proved very energetic and as strong as a man. Fourth aunt then definitely hired her, the wage being 500 cash per month. Everybody called her simply Sing Lin Sao, without asking for her surname. The old woman Wei was, however, a native of Wei Sha Shan, Wei Family Mountain, and since she claimed that Sing Lin Sao came from that village, no doubt her surname also was Wei. Like most mountaineers, she talked little, and only answered others' questions in monosyllables, and so it took more than 10 days to pry out of her the bare facts that there was still a severe mother-in-law in her home, that her young brother-in-law cut wood for a living, that she had lost her husband, 10 years her junior, in the previous spring, and that he had also lived by cutting firewood. This was about all people could get out of her. Day following day, and Sing Lin Sao's work was just as regular. She never slackened up, she never complained about the food, she never seemed to tire. People agreed that old Lord Lo Shi had found a worthy worker, quick and diligent, more so, in fact, than a man. Even at New Year she did all the sweeping, dusting, washing, and other household duties, besides preparing geese and chickens and all the sacrifices, without any other help. She seemed to thrive on it. Her skin became whiter, and she fattened a little. New Year had just passed when one day she came hurrying up from the canal where she had been washing rice. She was much agitated. She said she had seen, on the opposite bank, a man who looked very much like her late husband's first cousin, and she was afraid he had come to take her away. Fourth aunt was alarmed and suspicious. Why should he be coming for her? Asked for details, Sing Lin Sao could give none. Fourth uncle, when he heard the story, wrinkled his brow and announced, "This is very bad. It looks as though she has run away instead of being ordered." And as it turned out, he was correct. She was a runaway widow. Some 10 days later, when everybody was gradually forgetting the incident, old woman Wei suddenly appeared, accompanied by a woman who, she claimed, was Sing Lin Sao's mother-in-law. The latter seemed not at all like a tongue-bound mountaineer, but knew how to talk, and after a few courtesy words got to the subject of her business at once. She said she had come to take her daughter-in-law back home. It was spring, there was much to be done at home, and in the house at present were none but the very old and the very young. Sing Lin Sao was needed. "Since it's her own mother-in-law who requests it, how can we deny the justice of it?" said fourth uncle. Sing Lin Sao's wage, therefore, was figured out. It was discovered that altogether 1,750 cash were due. She had let the sum accumulate with her master, not taking out even a single cash for use. Without any more words, this amount was handed over to the mother-in-law, though Sing Lin Sao was not present. The woman also took Sing Lin Sao's clothes, thanked fourth uncle, and left. It was then past noon. "Aya, the rice! Didn't Sing Lin Sao go out to scour the rice?" Fourth aunt, some time later, cried out this question in a startled way. She had forgotten all about Sing Lin Sao until her hunger reminded her of rice, and the rice reminded her of the former servant. Everybody scattered and began searching for the rice basket. Fourth aunt herself went first to the kitchen, next to the front hall, and then into the bedroom, but she didn't see a shadow of the object of her search. Fourth uncle wandered outside, but he saw nothing of it either until he came near the canal. There, upright on the bank, was the cabbage nearby, lay the missing basket. Apparently not until then had anyone thought to inquire in what manner Sing Lin Sao had departed with her mother-in-law. Now eyewitnesses appeared who reported that early in the morning a boat, carrying a white canopy, anchored in the canal and lay there idly for some time. The awning hid the occupants, and no one knew who was in it. Presently, Sing Lin Sao came to the bank, and just as she was about to kneel down for water, two men quickly jumped out, grabbed her, and forcibly put her inside the boat. They seemed to be mountain people, but they certainly took her against her will. She cried and shouted for help several times. Afterwards, she was hushed up, evidently with some kind of gag. Nothing more happened until the arrival of two women, one of whom was Old Woman Wei. Nobody saw very clearly what had happened to Sing Lin Sao, but those who peered in declared that she seemed to have been bound and thrown on the deck of the cabin. "Outrageous!" exclaimed Fourth Uncle. On reflection, however, he simply ended impotently, "But after all..." Fourth Aunt herself had to prepare the food that day, and her son, An Yu, made the fire. In the afternoon, Old Woman Wei reappeared. "Outrageous!" Fourth Uncle greeted her. "What is this? How wonderful! You have honored us once more with your presence," Fourth Aunt, washing dishes, angrily shouted at the old bargain-maker. "You yourself recommended her to us. Then you come with companions to abduct her from the household. This affair is a veritable volcanic eruption. How do you suppose it will look to outsiders? Are you playing a joke at our expense, or what is it?"
"Aya, aya! I have surely been fooled and tricked. I came here to explain to you. Now how was I to know she was a rebel? She came to me, begged me to get her work, and I took her for genuine. Who would have known that she was doing it behind her mother-in-law's back, without in fact even asking for permission? I'm unable to look in your face, my lord and my lady. It's all my fault, the fault of a careless old fool. I can't look you in the face. Fortunately, your home is generous and forgiving, and will not punish insignificant people like myself too strictly, eh? And next time the person I recommend must be doubly good to make up for this sin."
"But," interjected Fourth Uncle, who, however, could get no farther. And so the affair of Sing Lin Sao came to an end, and indeed she herself would have been entirely forgotten were it not that the fourth aunt had such difficulty with subsequent servants. They were too lazy, or they were too gluttonous, or in extreme cases they were both lazy and gluttonous, and in truth were totally undesirable, from the extreme left to the extreme right. In her distress, Fourth Aunt always mentioned the exemplary Sing Lin Sao. "I wonder how she is living," she would say, inwardly wishing that some misfortune would oblige her to return to work. By the time the next new year rolled around, however, she had given up hope of ever seeing her again. Toward the end of the holidays, Old Woman Wei called one day to kowtow and offer felicitations. She had already drunk herself into semi-intoxication and was in a garrulous mood. She explained that because of a visit to her mother's home in Wei Village, where she had stayed for several days, she was late this year in paying her courtesy calls. During the course of the conversation, their talk naturally touched upon Sing Lin Sao.
"She?" the old woman cried shrilly and with alcoholic enthusiasm. "There's a lucky woman! You know, when her mother-in-law came after her here, she had at that time already been promised to a certain Hu Lao Liu of Hu Village. After staying in her home only a few days, she was loaded again into the flowery sedan chair and borne away."
"Ay-ya, what a mother!" Fourth Aunt exclaimed.
"Ay-ya, my lady, you speak from behind a lofty door. We mountaineers of the small-doored families, for us, what does it matter? You see, she had a young brother-in-law, and he had to be married. If Sang Lin Sao was not married off first, where would the family get money enough for the brother-in-law's presents to his betrothed? So you understand the mother-in-law is by no means a stupid woman, but keen and calculating. Moreover, she married the daughter-in-law to an inner mountain dweller. Why? Don't you see? Marrying her to a local man, she would have got only a small betrothal gift. But since few women want to marry deep into the mountains, the price is higher. Hence the husband actually paid 80,000 cash for Sing Lin Sao. Now the son of the family has also been married, and he gave his bride presents costing but 5,000 cash. After deducting the cost of the wedding, there still remained over 10,000 cash profit. Is she clever or not? Good figuring, eh?"
"And Sing Lin Sao, she obeyed all right?"
"Well, it wasn't a question of obedience with her. Anybody in such a situation has to make a protest, of course. They simply tie her up, lift her into the flowery sedan chair, bear her away to the groom's home, forcibly put the flowery hat on her head, forcibly make her kowtow in the ancestral hall, forcibly lock her up with the man, and the thing is done. Aya! But Sing Lin Sao was unusually rebellious. I heard people say that she made a terrific struggle. In fact, it was said that she was different from most women, probably because she had worked in your home, the home of a scholar. My lady, I've seen much in these years. Among widows who remarry, I've seen the kind who cry and shout. I have seen those who threaten suicide. There is, in addition, the kind who, after being taken to the groom's home, refuse to make the kowtow to heaven and earth, and even go so far as to smash the flowery candles used to light the bridal chamber. But Sin Lin Sao was like none of these demonstrators. From the very beginning, she fought like a tigress. She screamed and she cursed, and by the time she reached Hu village, her throat was so raw that she had almost lost her voice. She had to be dragged out of the sedan chair. It took two men to get her into the ancestral hall, and still she would not kowtow. Only for one moment they carelessly loosened their grip on her, and Aya, by Buddha's name, she knocked her head a sound whack on the incense altar and cut a deep gash from which blood spurted out thickly. They used two handfuls of incense ash on the wound and bound it up with two thicknesses of red cloth, and still it bled. Actually, she struggled till the very last, when they locked her with her husband in the bridal room, and even then she cursed. This was indeed a protest. Aya, it really was. She shook her gnarled head, bent her gaze on the floor, and was silent. How was it afterwards? They say she did not get up the first day, nor the second. Afterwards? After that, oh, she finally got up. At the end of the year, she bore him a child, a boy. While I was at my mother's home, I saw some people who had returned from Hu village, and they had seen her. Mother and son were both fat. Above their heads was fortunately no mother-in-law. Her husband, it seems, is strong and a good worker. He owns his house. Aya, she's a lucky one indeed. From that time on, Fourth Aunt gave up any thought of Sing Lin Sao's excellent work, or at any rate she ceased to mention her name. 3. In the autumn, 2 years after Old Woman Wei had brought news of Sing Lin Sao's extraordinary good luck, our old servant stood once more in person before the hall of Fourth Uncle's home. On the table she laid a round chestnut-shaped basket and a small bedding roll. She still wore a white scarf on her head, a black skirt, a blue jacket, and a moon-white vest. Her complexion was about the same, except that her cheeks had lost all their color. Traces of tears lay in the corners of her eyes, from which all the old brightness and luster seemed washed away. Moreover, with her once more appeared Old Woman Wei, wearing on her face an expression of a commiseration. She babbled to Fourth Aunt, "So it is truly said, heaven holds many an unpredictable wind and cloud. Her husband was a strong and healthy man. Who would have guessed that at a green age he would be cut down by fever? He had actually recovered from the illness, but ate a bowl of cold rice, and it attacked him again. Fortunately, she had the son. By cutting wood, plucking tea leaves, raising silkworms, and she is skilled at each of these jobs, she could make a living." Could anyone have predicted that the child itself would be carried off by a wolf? A fact, by a wolf. It was already late spring, long after the time when anyone fears a wolf. Who could have anticipated this one's boldness? Aya! And now she's left only her one bare body. Her late husband's elder brother-in-law took possession of the house and everything in it, and he drove her out without a cash. She is, in fact, in the no-road, no-destination predicament, and can but return to beg you to take her in once more. She no longer has any connections, such as a mother-in-law, whatever. Knowing you want to change servants, I brought her along. Since she already knows your ways, it's certain she'll be more satisfactory than a raw hand. I was truly stupid, truly, said Sing Lin Sao in a piteous voice, and lifting up her faded eyes for a moment. I knew that when the snow lies in the mountains, the wild animals will sometimes venture into the valleys, and will even come into the village in search of food. I did not know that they could be so fierce long after the coming of spring. I got up early one morning, took a small basket of beans, and told little Ah Mao to sit in the doorway and string the beans. He was very bright, and he was obedient. He always listened to every word, and this morning he did so, and I left him in the door. I myself went behind the house to chop kindling and to scour rice. I had just put the rice in the boiler and was ready to cook the beans, so I called to Ah Mao. He didn't answer. I went round to the door, but there was no Ah Mao, only beans scattered on the ground. He never wandered to play, but I hurried to each door to ask for him. Nobody had seen him. I was terror-stricken. I begged people to help me hunt for him. All the morning and into the afternoon we moved back and forth, looking into every corner. Finally we found one of his little shoes hanging on a thorn bush. From that moment everyone said that he had been seized by a wolf, but I would not believe it. After a little while, going farther into the mountains, we found him. Lying in a grassy lair was his body, with the five organs missing, but the bean basket was still tightly clutched in his little hand. Here she broke down and could only make incoherent sounds without stringing a sentence together. Fourth Aunt had at first hesitated, but after hearing this story her eyes reddened, and she instantly told the widow to take her things to the servants' quarters. Old Woman Wei sighed with relief, as if she had just put down a heavy bundle. Sing Lin Sao quieted somewhat, and without waiting for a second invitation, she took her bedding roll into the familiar room. Thus she once more became a worker in Lo Ching, and everybody still called her Sing Lin Sao after her first husband. But she was no longer the same woman. After a few days, her mistress and master noticed that she was heavy of hand and foot, that she was listless at her work, that her memory was bad, and over her corpse-like face all day there never crossed a shadow of a smile. One could tell by Fourth Aunt's tone of voice that she was already dissatisfied, and with Fourth Uncle it was the same. He had, as usual, wrinkled his brow in disapproval when she first arrived, but since they had been having endless difficulties with servants, he had raised no serious objection to the re-employment of Sing Lin Sao. Now, however, he informed Fourth Aunt that, though the woman's case seemed indeed very lamentable, and it was permissible because of that to give her work, still she was obviously out of tune with heaven and earth. She must not, therefore, be allowed to pollute precious vessels with her soiled hands, and especially on ceremonial occasions Fourth Aunt herself must prepare all food. Otherwise the ancestral spirits would be offended, and likely as not refuse to touch a crumb. These ancestral sacrifices were, in fact, the most important affairs in Fourth Uncle's home, for he still rigidly adhered to the old beliefs. Formerly they had been busy times for Sin Lin Sao also, and so the next time the altar was placed in the center of the hall and covered with a fine cloth, she began to arrange the wine cups and bowls and chopsticks on it exactly as before. "Sin Lin Sao," Fourth Aunt cried, rushing in. "Never mind that. I'll fix the things." Puzzled, she withdrew and proceeded to take out the candlesticks. "Never mind that either. I'll get the sticks," Fourth Aunt said again. Sin Lin Sao walked about several times in a rather dazed manner and ended up by finding nothing to do, for Fourth Aunt was always ahead of her. She went away suspiciously. She found the only use they had for her that day was to sit in the kitchen and keep the fire burning. People in Lo Ching continued to call her Sin Lin Sao, but there was a different tone in their voices. They still talked with her, but smiled in a cool way and with faint contempt. She did not seem to notice, or perhaps did not care. She only stared beyond them and talked always about the thing that day and night clung to her mind. "I was truly stupid, truly," she would repeat. "I only knew that when the snow lies on the mountains, the wild animals will sometimes venture into the valleys and will even come into the villages in search of food. I did not know that they would be fierce long after the coming of spring." Retelling her story in the same words, she would end up sobbing and striking her breast. Everyone who heard it was moved, and even the sneering men listening would loosen their smiles and go off in depressed spirits. The women not only forgot all their contempt for her, but at the moment forgave her entirely for her black sins, remarrying and causing the death not only of a second husband, but also of his child, and in many cases ended by joining with her and weeping at the end of the tragic narrative. She talked of nothing else, only this incident that had become the central fact of her life, and she told it again and again. Before long, however, the entire population of Lo Ching had heard her story not once but several times, and the most generous old women, even the Buddha chanters, could not muster up a tear when she spoke of it. Nearly everybody in the town could recite the story word for word, and it bored them excessively to hear it repeated. "I was truly stupid, truly," she would begin. Yes, you only knew that when the snow lies on the mountains, the wild animals will sometimes venture into the valleys and will even come into the villages in search of food. Her audience would recite the next lines, cruelly cutting her short, and walk away. With her mouth hanging open, Sing Lin Sao would stand stupefied for a while, stare as if seeing someone for the first time, and then drag away slowly as if weary of her continued existence. But her obsession gave her no rest, and she ingenuously tried to interest others in it by indirect approaches. Seeing a bean, a small basket, or other people's children, she would innocently lead up to the tragedy of Ao Mao. Looking at a child 3 or 4 years old, for instance, she would say, "If Ao Mao were still here, he would be just about that size." Frightened by the wild light in Sing Lin Sao's eyes, the children signaled for a retreat by pulling on their mother's skirts. She would therefore soon find herself alone again and falter off until the next time. Pretty soon everyone understood these tactics too and made fun of her. When they saw her staring morosely at an infant, they would look at her mockingly. "Sing Lin Sao, if our Ao Mao were still here, wouldn't he be just about that big?" Probably she had not suspected that her misery had long since ceased to afford any vicarious enjoyment for anyone, and that the whole episode had now become loathsome to her former sympathizers. But the meaning of this kind of mockery pierced her armor of preoccupation at last, and she understood. She glanced at the jester, but did not utter a word of response. 4. Lo Ching never loses his enthusiasm for the celebration of New Year. Promptly after the 20th of the 12th moon, the festivities begin. Next year, at this time, Fourth Uncle hired an extra male worker, and in addition a certain Lu Ma, to prepare the chickens and geese. This Lu Ma was a good woman, a Buddhist vegetarian who really kept her vow not to kill living creatures. Sin Lin Sao, whose hands were polluted, could only feed the fire and sit watching Lu Ma working over the sacred vessels. Outside, a fine snow was matting the earth. "Ah, yeah, I was truly stupid," sighed Sin Lin Sao, staring despondently at the sky. "Sin Lin Sao, you are back on the same trail," Lu Ma interrupted with some exasperation. "Listen to me. Is it true you got the scar by knocking your forehead against the altar in protest?" "Mm-hmm. I ask you this. If you hated it that much, how was it that later on you actually submitted?"
"I?"
"Ah, you. It seems to me you must have been half willing otherwise."
"Ha, ha, you don't understand how great were his muscles."
"No, I don't. I don't believe that strength such as your own was not enough to resist him. It is clear to me that you must have been ready for it yourself."
"Ah, you. I'd like to see you try it yourself and see how long you could struggle."
Liu Ma's old face crinkled into a laugh so that it looked like a polished walnut. Her dry eyes rested on Sin Lin Sao's scar for a moment and then sought out her eyes. She spoke again. "You are really not very clever. One more effort that time to really kill yourself would have been better for you. As it is, you lived with your second man less than 2 years, and that is all you got for your great crime. Just think about it. When you go into the next world, you will be held in dispute between the spirits of your two husbands. How can the matter be settled? Only one way. Yen Luta, the Emperor of Hell, can do nothing else but saw you in half and divide you equally between the two men. That, I think, is a fact." An expression of mingled fear and astonishment crept over Sin Lin Sao's face. This was something she had not considered before, had never even heard in her mountain village. "My advice is that you'd better make amends before it's too late. Go to the Tuti Temple and contribute money for a threshold. This threshold, stepped on by 1,000, stepped over by 10,000, can suffer for you and perhaps atone for the crime. Thus you may avoid suffering after death." Sin Lin Sao did not say a word, but felt intolerably crushed with pain. Next day, dark shadows encircled her eyes. Right after breakfast, she went off to the Tuti Temple to beg the priest to let her buy a new threshold. He stubbornly refused at first, and only when she released a flood of tears would he consider it. Then unwillingly, he admitted that it might be arranged for 12,000 cash. She had long since stopped talking with the villagers, who shunned her and the tiresome narrative of Ao Mao's death, but news soon spread that there was a development in her case. Many people came now and inquisitively referred to the scar on her forehead. "Sin Lin Sao, I ask you this. Why was it that you submitted to the man?" "Regrettable, regrettable," sighed another, "that the knock was not deep enough."
She understood well enough the mockery and irony of their words, and she did not reply. She simply continued to perform her duties in silence. Near the end of next year's service, she drew the money due to her from Fourth Aunt, exchanged it for 12 silver dollars, and asked permission to visit in the west end of the town. Before the next meal, she returned, much altered. Her face no longer seemed troubled. Her eyes held some life in them for the first time in months, and she was in a cheerful mood. She told Fourth Aunt that she had bought a threshold for the temple. During the coming of Winter Festival, she worked tirelessly, and on the day of making sacrifices, she was simply bursting with energy. Fourth Aunt brought out the holy utensils, and An Yu carried the altar to the center of the room. Sing Lin Cao promptly went over to bring out the wine cups and chopsticks. "Never mind," Fourth Aunt cried out. "Don't touch them." She withdrew her hand as if it had been burned. Her face turned ashen, and she did not move, but stood as if transfixed. She remained standing there, in fact, until Fourth Uncle came in to light the offertory incense and ordered her away. From that day, she declined rapidly. It was not merely a physical impoverishment that ensued, but the spark of life in her was dimmed almost to extinction. She became extremely nervous and developed a morbid fear of darkness or the sight of anyone, even her master or mistress. She became altogether as timid and frightened as a little mouse that has wandered from its hole to blink for a moment in the glaring light of day. In half a year her hair lost all its color. Her memory became so clouded that she sometimes forgot even to scour the rice. What has got into her? How has she become like that? It's better not to have her around, Fourth Aunt began saying in her presence. But become like that she had, and there did not seem to be any possibility of improving her. They talked of sending her away or of returning her to the management of Old Woman Wei. Nothing came of it while I was still in Lo Qing, but the plan was soon afterwards carried out. Whether Old Woman Wei actually took charge of her for a while after she left Fourth Uncle's home, or whether she at once became a beggar, I never learned. I am awakened by giant crackers and see yellow tongues of flame, and then immediately afterwards hear the sharp pee-pee-pow of exploding gunpowder. It is near the fifth hour, and time for the prayers and blessings. Still only drowsily aware of the world, I hear far away the steady explosive notes, one after another, and then more rapidly and thickly, until the whole sky is echoing, and the whirling snowflakes, eddying out of little white balls themselves like something shot from above, hover everywhere. Within the compass of the medley of sound and gentle storm, I feel somehow a nostalgic contentment, and all the brooding of the dead day in the early night is forgotten in the stir around me, lost in the air of expectancy that pervades these homes about to receive benediction. What a satisfaction it is to understand that the holy spirits of heaven and earth, having bountifully inhaled their fill of the offertory meat and wine and incense, now limp about drunkenly in the wide air. In such a mood, they are certain to dispense boundless prosperity on the good people of Lo Qing. And that story was Benediction by Lu Sun, from Great Short Stories of the Masters, edited by Charles Nieder. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from Great Short Stories of the World, edited by Lois Hill. Out of the Storm by Malloy Finnegan. Chuggins, Nevada, was having one of its three-day winds. Rain started in, too, and blew with everything else. Tin cans went tumbling over one another down Golden Street, gathering up beer bottles as they went along, the swishing rain driving everything loose before it. At the upper end of Golden Street, and then back up the slope a bit, in her little dry goods box of a house, made from several boxes, dry goods and otherwise, Phil Martin's wife lay listening to the clattering procession and wondering where all the tin cans came from. The little house itself rocked like a ship at sea, and, but for the friendly shoulder of the hill it leaned against, might have joined in the mad procession, as some of its scattered neighbors, less fortunately anchored, occasionally did. Phil Martin's wife raised herself on an elbow and tried to look out through the rain-splashed window beside her bed. A little dog came from somewhere and tried to look out, too. "No, Monk," she said. "He's not coming yet." She shaded her eyes with her hand to keep out the bleary streaks of light that reached up at her, from downtown, through the wet darkness, the better to see in another direction, at right angles with them, only darting back when a sudden flash of lightning obliterated them entirely, illuminating the surrounding mountains and making them quiver in the bellowing thunder that followed. All at once she spied a tiny light, like a faraway star. It was what she was looking for. She knew it came from the lantern carried by her husband on his way home from the Bonnie Bell mine, where he was working on the night shift. "Here he comes now," she said, springing from the bed and stepping into the felt slippers beside it. "Row, row, row," said the little dog, who was still very young, scratching at the door to be let out to meet his master. "Not yet," said his mistress, shaking her head and its long brown braid and throwing a warm wrapper over her nightdress. "He's not near enough yet." Then she turned up the wick in the coal oil lamp and busied herself making things comfortable. She put some wood and paper in the sheet iron stove and soon had a lively fire, which roared with the wind in the polished stovepipe that ran straight up through the low ceiling. When she had the coffee pot on, she drew up the one comfortable armchair. She placed across it some flannel pajamas and in front of it a pair of warm slippers. "Let's see," she said, trying to think of something else. "He'll be pretty hungry when he comes in out of that storm. Let's cook him some ham and eggs." She talked to the dog, a little black fellow with a white cross on his chest. He had retreated from the door at her bidding and was playing with one of the slippers before the fire, never so intent on the pastime that his ears did not prick at attention for a sound of his master's approaching footstep. "Grrr, woof!" He dropped the slipper and bounded for the door, but his mistress finished breaking the eggs in a bowl and covering them over with a saucer before she answered his imperative demand to open it. Hardly had she slipped the bolt than the door flew back against her, and a man's form came in with it out of the night and the storm. "Down, monk!" she commanded. The dog was making great leaps at the stranger, who, although he slammed the door quickly behind him, in the face of resisting wind and rain, brought plenty of them in with him. "He'll not bite you," she said to the half-drowned man. "Just wants to make friends." It had not occurred to her to be afraid till she saw the stranger lock the door and put the key in his pocket. Then he shot the bolt. "Who else is here?" he demanded in a husky voice, taking in at a glance the one room of the cabin. The eyes he turned back on her through the drippings that trickled from his pulled-down slouch hat made her hesitate as she answered, "Nobody, not now." "Not now," he repeated, as if to get her meaning. "Oh," he exclaimed, as his gaze lighted on the coffee pot and the eggshells, and taking in the slippers and pajamas, traveled to the rumpled bed. "You mean somebody was here and has just gone to work. I know they change shifts over at the Bonnie Bell about this time. Is that it?" "Yes," she answered, falling into the lie intuitively. Past him, through the little window, she could see the light coming down the side of the mountain. It was still very small. Of course, it had the storm to fight, but oh, why didn't it hurry? "Then," the man was saying, "we're not apt to be disturbed for some 8 hours, am I right?" And again she lied. "Yes." He removed his hat and shook the drippings into the wood box. Then, unbuttoning his khaki coat, threw back its collar and turned down the collar of the double-breasted blue flannel shirt underneath, the flying moisture sizzling against the tiny stove. "Then, for mercy's sake, fix me up something to eat," he said. "I'm starved." He dropped into the chair before the fire and let his head fall between his hands, as if able to hold up no longer. As she pushed back some sewing things on the table to make room for the dishes, she watched the nervous fingers digging into the thick, unkempt hair. They belonged to the hands of a working man, but one who had been estranged from soap and water for some time, excepting what the rain furnished. What she could see of the face told the same story and needed shaving besides. The steam-emitting khaki clothes looked as if he slept in them. He dragged a chair to the table and started eating before she was ready for him, munching bread till she got the ham and eggs to his plate, and then hurrying them down his throat with great swallows of coffee, which he drew with a swishing sound through his mustache. "I don't want to harm you, ma'am," he said, gulping down a final chunk of bread and slipping back his chair, "but I want to get a couple of hours' sleep before daylight. All you've got to do is keep quiet. It wouldn't do you any good hollering anyhow in this storm, even if your neighbors weren't so far away. And whoever comes in that door, I'll blow his brains out." He reached around to his hip pocket and drew from it a six-shooter. The frightened woman knew he wasn't only talking. She watched him stagger toward the bed she so recently vacated and tumble into it, wet clothing, boots and all. "Better turn down the light," he drowsily ordered, adjusting his hand over the gun on the coverlet. "Same as you had it before it attracted me this way. It might attract somebody else. Better turn it out altogether. Hardly done before his snores vied with the outside elements. Noiselessly, Phil Martin's wife tiptoed to the door and drew back the bolt, but the lock was locked for keeps. Then she turned to the little window. It was in a side wall of the cabin, at right angles with the one containing the door. If it was large enough to admit her, she would have to climb over the snoring man to get to it, and even then she would be obliged to lift the sash and break through the screen tacked on from the outside. One of the muddy yellow boots slipping to the floor startled her, but the snores didn't miss a beat. The firelight revealed the figure on the bed, lying on its back, the slipped boot dragging on the floor. Should he sit up suddenly, he would be facing the door, and she could well believe that he would keep his word about the gun. Across him she could see the light coming down the mountain. How it was growing! Her lips moved in prayer as she watched it, a desperate prayer that its bearer might stumble and turn an ankle or even break an arm. It would be better than having his brains blown out in his own doorway. Should she risk her life and scream when he got nearer? Willingly, willingly, but that would only hurry him on, not drive him back. Then she prayed again, and all this time the light was getting nearer and larger. It could not have been more than a block away when something brought her gaze back to her surroundings. The room about her was quite dark. The fire had almost died out. A new terror seized her. She groped her way to the wood box and stooped to get some fuel to replenish the dying fire, when she felt the little dog settling himself on her skirts. She put out a hand to pat him, thankful for his nearness, but it stopped in the middle of the caress as a drop of moisture fell on the back of it. Even in the dark, the natural instinct was to look up to see where the water came from. A sudden flash of lightning revealed a crescent-shaped opening, like a new moon, a thin slice of the stovepipe hole. Then it was dark again. On the heels of the thunderclap that followed, she could hear the outside chimney, which some merciful wind had blown off, go clattering over the roof and off it to join the other tin things rolling down Golden Street. With a sudden inspiration, she snatched the dog to her and hunted around in the wood box for the empty egg crate. She remembered throwing it there. Then she remembered her sewing basket on the table and blindly made her way to it, knocking over the lately used cup and its saucer when she got there. Frightened, she paused for developments, but the noise it made was such a slight one compared to the surrounding bedlam that it caused no perceptible difference in the snores issuing from the bed. The sewing basket located, she fingered around in it for a piece of blue tailor's chalk which she always kept there. When she found it, she unlocked the cardboard strips of the egg crate and selected one. Then she seated herself at the table, while the dog, cuddled in her left arm, affectionately licked her neck where it rose out of the wrapper. With her right hand she blindly traced what ought to read, "Don't come unarmed, bring help." She folded the strip of cardboard and refolded it, and wrapping the little bunch in her pocket handkerchief, tied it securely to Monk's leather collar. They both trembled as she climbed up on the chair, feeling along the still warm stovepipe till she came to the crescent-shaped opening. With a handful of her wrapper, she shoved the pipe further aside. Taking the shivering dog in her two hands, she reached up and tried to force him through the enlarged stovepipe hole. His head once out, he slipped from her hand so quickly that she almost lost her balance. She knew that Monk had seen his master and recognized him. Once out, it was an easy thing for him to run along the roof and down the side of the hill into which it was built. When she could recover her breath, she pushed the pipe back in place and descended to firmer footing. The light was so near that she almost screamed. She held her breath when she saw it approach the ground, as if its bearer was stooping to pat the dog, for instance. Then her heart came up in her throat and stuck there while she waited for it to move on again. When it did, it took another direction. It went downtown. "Thank God," she breathed. She began to feel cold. She drew her wrapper about her and huddled, with her feet tucked up under her, in the big armchair before the dead fire. Once the man on the bed stirred and mumbled something incoherent, but his words died away in gurgles as his big snore again filled the dark room. She waited, she knew not for what. Even if the man woke, he would never guess what she had done. He might think she had fallen asleep and let the fire die out. Even if he knew that the wind blew the chimney off and the rain put it out, it would make no difference. She got up and looked across him again, but all that she could see was the streaky light from downtown. If there was anything on its way to her, it was lost in those streaks. Returning to the chair, a drowsiness came over her. She wasn't anxious about Phil anymore. She was even wishing that the man on the bed would finish his sleep and go. She was so tired, and the cabin wasn't a cabin anymore. It was a boat. She liked the rocking and the splashing of the waves on its sides. A sudden crash brought her to as a door burst in and a flash of light revealed the gun in the hand of the man on the bed. She uttered a piercing scream which almost drowned the report that followed. But it came through the little window, and the extended arm dropped helpless while the gun clattered to the floor. Men came from everywhere. "So it's you, Buck Hennessy, is it?" said Casey, the sheriff, snapping the bracelets on the wounded man's wrists. "Sorry we couldn't let you finish your sleep, but they want you right bad over at Goldfield for holding up Jim Breen, paymaster of the Gold Bar, and putting him out of business. Maybe you'll be able to tell them what you did with the 2 sacks of currency you got away with. You see, the miners would like their pay. Been hiding around in our nice hills here about 3 days now, haven't you? And thought you'd get over to Beatty and catch that train in the morning? Not this trip, Buck. Just walk on ahead of me. Make room for him, gentlemen." When the cabin was cleared of the crowd, made up mostly of men from the 77 Saloon, where Phil Martin found them killing the lonely hours of the wet night with poker, roulette, faro, craps, and a few other innocent amusements, the big oilskin-coated miner put his arms around his little wife and let her cry on his shoulder. "Poor little girlie," he crooned, patting the heaving form in the soot-streaked wrapper. "You've had a night of it." As he tried to tell her about the $500 reward that was coming to her, the little dog was bouncing around them, yelping and barking for attention. "You too, Monk," he said, picking him up from the floor and holding the little black bundle tenderly against his face. "You'll get a nice gold collar." And that story was Out of the Storm by Molloy Finnegan from Great Short Stories of the World, edited by Lois Hill. That's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio.